Okay. Today is Monday morning, June 7th, 2021, and everything here is grinding to a halt. Students have already gone back. I will give shiur next week, Be'ezrat Hashem, and that's it. June 15th officially, Gris is out of session, and the summer programs are in. I just want to mention in relation, I told the story of the two glasses to break that were waiting for me at Kibbutz Chafetz Chaim. So I got an interesting email from David Lockhalter, that's from the coast, Los Angeles, and he describes at a wedding in Israel he watched on Zoom. The glass was broken right after Kiddushin, before the Sheva Brachas were recited. And I'll tell you what the reason is there. That is, in Israel, particularly at the Sephardic weddings, the truth of the matter is that the wedding really ends with the Kiddushin. Of course, a minute later, they're standing under the chuppah, and that itself is the Nisuin, and you really don't need the, according to the Rambam, you don't need Yichud. The Yichud is their being together under the chuppah. And halacha kama v'kama in Israel, where this minig developed of giving the chatan a talit, he makes a shechiyanu on the new bigud, and generally he spreads it over himself and the kala. So you really have a concept of chuppah and yichud according to the Rambam. So that's why I think the minig began, that a lot of people break the kos right after the kedushin, because the sheva brachot is like a Yehudaviyot, it's an addendum, but it's not the part and heart of the ceremony. But be it as it may, when I'm beside a Kedushin and I do Yichud, I have to do on an Ashkenaz, particularly if the Chatan is Ashkenaz. So when all is said and done, we keep to the traditional breaking of the kos at the very end of the ceremony. I want to pick up where I left off last week. We were talking about Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky and Dr. Joe, their second cousins. And what you see between the lines is that Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky was a unifying force, and I would say at the same time a pacifying force in the Moetzet, if we can call it that, the Rabbinic Advisory Board of Torah Mesorah. You got to remember there were people, and among them Gedolei Yisrael, who really felt that the only way you can teach Torah in America is sereid in Yiddish. And could you imagine where we'd be today if we had insisted back in 1940 only schools that teach in Yiddish are part of Torah Mesorah? And these problems come up all along, as we've indicated. The Rabbinic Advisory Board had to deal with very delicate problems. It's near high school girls. I mean, you can't start to envision how difficult this problem is, because the girls go along with fashion. They don't realize, and this has come up in modern times, judges have ruled that women are guilty by inciting men with their indecent dress, and the feminists go crazy. But the way God created the world, there's no question that the man is zemegaret hayetzim shaset hakelev, and the woman feels, what's wrong with my dress? I want to be cool, it's summer, etc. And these are very delicate problems. There's no doubt in my mind what you can do in New York, you may not be able to do in Kalamazoo, Michigan. And anyone in Chinuch understands this. And therefore, the same thing, I remember when I went into my first shtela, I built an Orthodox shul from the ground. So the mechitza to begin with, as I recall, was 50 inches. And you could, say 50 inches, it's a b'di'evet, sh'b'di'evet. All right, in New York, you could demand a 65-inch mechitza. In Maplewood, South Orange, building the first Orthodox shul with tremendous temples, Reformed, Conservative, Reconstructionist, it was an achievement. Later, I was able to raise the mechitza, and I'm sure today the shul is in the hands of Rabbi Bogomolsky Jr., with an erev and a mikvah and all that goes with it. So I'm sure today the Mekitzer is a lot larger than 50 inches, but this is where Rabbi Yaakov, having been in the rabbinate in Europe and by nature of his life, Toronto and Brooklyn and Muncie, he saw a lot more than most Rosh Yeshiva saw. And you read between the lines, you see that the two cousins complemented each other. Now, the beautiful article that I read to you and started, I'm going to come back to it today, from Jewish Action. So I'm very proud to say that Gary Torgo is a Yeshiva College graduate, 1978. And you can now understand where he's coming from, and he was quite successful as a lawyer, as we will see. And someone who knew him writes to me, Jeff Francis, I hope I'm pronouncing it right. When I was a kid growing up in Detroit in the early 70s, Gary Torgo was a member of the first graduating class of Yeshivat Akiva, the modern Orthodox Mizrahi day school in Detroit. His family was very active, and Rabbi James Gordon, that's Jimmy Gordon, Zichrono Levracha, I knew him very well, it's Macy Gordon's older brother. He was rabbi of Young Israel of Oak Woods, a suburb of Oak Park, a suburb of Detroit. I know he went to YU, and at some point he became the regional director of Central East NCSY. He was charismatic and a substantive guy and always authentic, who struck me as the real deal, in quotations, at least from the perspective of a young 20 to 14-year-old kid. And he goes on to describe his life. He became an attorney, etc. But I have to say it's a tremendous compliment to Gary Torgo. Here's a YU product growing up in Young Israel and becoming so active in Torah Mesorah, heading up the more right-wing day school, if I can use that term, and I believe very active until today and very highly thought of. Now, we mentioned what's involved in Torah Mesorah and what's involved in fundraising and a yeshiva, and he gives all the credit to his Rebbe, who the person who became the dominant rabbinic figure in his life, Rabbi Avram Abba Friedman, who was sent by Mr. Mendelovich in 1944 to Detroit. And the story of how they call this generous family, and not totally frum, but a family that cares about perpetuating Yiddishkeit, and he makes the proposal, a gift for your wife, had a big birthday. And it's a beautiful thought. He dedicates the new campus that they're building for the girls' high school in honor of his wife. The girls' school of Yeshivat Bet Yehuda. It may not be the high school, maybe the elementary school and the high school. And it's very moving, very beautiful, how at the party he says, I have a very unique gift for you. And she says, I hope it's not jewelry, I hope it's not another house, I hope it's not this, not that. He says, no, I'm giving naming the campus of the girls' yeshiva in your honor. And his wife breaks into tears and says, Jimmy, that is the nicest gift I ever received. So, I mean, that story stands for itself and interpersonal relationships. Not easy, because we have to raise funds. It's a tremendous burden, the day school burden, when I see Jews give away billions of dollars to paganistic causes. It hurts me. What we could do with that money, lahadil Torah, lahadira. Okay, nekavel tov. But I want to go one step further, and here you'll see something very fascinating, and it ties together with something I mentioned in the Kollel over the decades. Rabbi Friedman taught Gary Torgo, who now is the president of the day school, whenever you get a donation, write a personal note. And people, even if it's a small donation, doesn't really affect the budget. But when you write a personal note, it shows that you care, that you just don't take it for granted. It has an impact. And Gary Torgo tells the following story. One of those donors who I corresponded with was a Holocaust survivor who worked for many years as a supervisor at the General Motors plant in Michigan. 3 or 4 times a year, he would send the yeshiva a $500 donation. And as my Rebbe had instructed, I wrote him a personal note each time the school received this check. After nearly a decade of communicating with him through personal cards and letters and thanks, both when receiving a donation and before Yomim Tovim, we learned one morning that he had passed away. He never had children. His wife had predeceased him. The funeral was a graveside one with only a minion of people in attendance. A few months after his passing, the controller of the yeshiva dropped a large package at my office in the yeshiva. Inside was a copy of every letter I had written to this man for over 10 years, as well as a note he had written a few months before his death. The note read, "Dear Gary, I cannot tell you how much these thank you letters meant to me. I read every one of them over and over, and felt so great every time I received one. I know $500 is not a lot of money, but you made me feel like a million-dollar giver. It warmed my heart, and I will never forget the love I felt." A few months later, a lawyer calls the yeshiva, and he asks to speak to Gary Torgo, and he tells Gary, "This man left his entire estate to the yeshiva, and it was a substantial sum of money." Now, where do you have exactly the same story? Do you remember? Exactly the same story in Queens. Excuse me. Exactly. Chafetz Chaim Yeshiva, the beautiful building, a block away from Lander College. And the story is legendary. I heard it many times, I heard it from the people involved. There was a vagabond who was not married. No one knew how he lived, where he lived. And he would come around the yeshiva, and students were friendly. And he got to know everyone in the yeshiva. And the Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Hanoch Leibovich, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, would send him a New Year's card every year. And no one thought this man had any assets. When he died, he left his entire estate to the yeshiva. It turned out he had inherited millions of dollars. And this is, those of you who have studied psychology, it's a bit of a mental illness. You can have all the money in the world, and yet you can't spend it. You can't use it. You don't know how to use it. There are many factors involved. And this man, I think it was $6 or $7 million, it put Chafetz Chaim over the top, and they were able to build that beautiful campus that they have in Kew Gardens Hills. So you see, it's exactly the same story. Again, I'll add another point that ties in with yesterday's shiur. Some people got frightened. The New York Times will pick up the stuff. First of all, we haven't finished the tshuva, but that Rav Menashe Klein comes in with such strident words that a guy is chayev mita if he's not mekayim the sheva mitzvah. And you see, these are Holocaust survivors. At least the story with Gary we know to be a Holocaust. I don't know all the details with Chafetz Chaim, but what Hitler did to us, it's 6 million dead, 5 million plus lives, and Jews until today, totally affected directly, not just indirectly, by the Holocaust. In order to run the state of Israel, if you don't go to Yad Vashem daily, you can't run the state properly, in my humble opinion. And this is a message we all understand, a message that, halavai, the New York Times and the Paganistic Society would understand it. I'm still shaking when I think 6 o'clock Yom Yerushalayim, I turned the news on and suddenly they interrupt into the bomb shelters and they're saying Yerushalayim. And if I didn't believe it, minutes later I heard the rockets falling. And imagine, we are accused by the New York Times of starting a war and purposely murdering Arab children. You all know that in the news today, it turns out that in the big school that the United Nations runs for the children in Gaza, it turns out that underneath the school was a whole tunnel with units to attack, etc. So, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, halavai, halavai, we can open the hearts, the mouths, the understanding, the mind. Okay. Ad kan Torah Mesorah. Again, I stress, it's Mr. Mendelovich's greatest achievement. It's one of the greatest achievements on the American scene. When Reb Moshe Feinstein stood up for Dr. Joe and told the Rosh Yeshiva visiting from Israel, Rav Ezrachi, this man, if not for him, there'd be no Torah across the length and breadth of America. And it's totally, totally true. And what an achievement, what vision, what foresight, what success. And today, hundreds of thousands of children study in yeshiva. Even in New York, we're not so happy with no secular or general studies curriculum, a core curriculum. The yeshiva are so powerful that no politician can challenge them. Now I want to move further. And I know in the past I've spoken about the Shlomo Lakarbach, I've spoken about Meir Kahana, haven't really spoken about Esther Jungreis, but now I want to speak about them in a different context. If we're talking about the history of Torah in the United States and the Western world, these three individuals play a role, and I have to say a very significant role, because their influence, what they did, what they established, it's something that has moved the youth, the generations beyond them, the Jewish people. I can only tell you, I think I mentioned on Friday, I think I mentioned it yesterday, I was Menachem Avil in Bat Ayin, the late Dr. Bernard Kabakow. By the way, Noach, he had very close relations with Satmar, because he was the main doctor in Beth Israel, and he was also at Mount Sinai, and he played a big role in the Bikur Cholim that they run, and he was in very good terms with Satmar. There was once a case of a husband wouldn't give a get. He made one phone call, and the guy was found half dead in a Staten Island cemetery with a note attached to him: if you don't give the get within a week, you're going to be underground, not on top of the ground. And he did give a get, by the way. So I was involved there. It was a sickening story of what human beings are capable of doing for the sake of money. And I want to try to recapture for you what I'm talking about. At this moment, I'm a young man of 23 years. I'm the happiest person in the world to be teaching Torah. But in reality, I'm not 23 years old. You have to add on another 60. I'm 83 years old. And my generation was very unique, very different. And I want to read to you a paragraph. I don't want to summarize. I want to read this paragraph. It appears in Rakofet Aron, Chelik Dalid, page 286. Ours was a generation that grew up in the shadow of the crematoria and the glow of the Israeli flag. While I was American-born, There were numerous Holocaust survivors among my fellow students. This was true of both my elementary school, Yeshiva Rabbi Yisrael Salanter of the Bronx, and my high school, Talmudical Academy in Manhattan. Yet we did not dwell on the past as we were engaged by the saga of the emerging state of Israel. We sought guidance and direction as we matured. How do we balance out the pain and tears of yesterday with the joy and pride of today? I don't think I've ever written a better paragraph than that paragraph. And this is, it's so correct. It so captures the era. Let me share with you some of my earliest memories of life. The earliest memory I have, I believe I write about this in Washington, was December 7th, 1941. And I remember my father was in the living room listening to the news. Radios then were consoles. They were like a three-story building, a radio. And my father is yelling to my mother in the kitchen. That's the way life was then. Women didn't leave the kitchen, basically. And when men had the day off, they were in the living room. And my father yelling to my mother, "Jenny, Jenny, we are at war." It was Pearl Harbor, December 7th. Of course, I was a kid, but I was 4 years old already. I was old enough. I had just turned four, December 2nd. I was old enough to understand we're at war. Of course, as a kid, I never dreamt how my entire eternity would be shaped by that war. But my earliest recollection, we're at war. Then I have another memory, which I believe I also write about in Washington. It had to be about 1943, 1944. I'm riding on the 3rd Avenue L. It doesn't exist anymore, but it was in the Bronx. It was a train above ground on 3rd Avenue. That's why it was called the 3rd Avenue L. And it actually went from the Bronx down to the east side. That's the famous Shiloh you'll find. We discussed it. They asked you, "It's called Hanan, if you pay in advance," which you could do, because there was a man sitting at the booth, generally an Irishman or an Italian, and you knew him. You always saw him every day, and you could arrange with him that tomorrow, if I can't carry money. They were very understanding. They were good Catholics. It was not a paganistic society yet. And you could pay and get on the train on Yontif. Simchas Torah, can I get on the train in the Bronx on 180th Street and go down to East Broadway, where there was action, where there was joy, where there was the Biyana Rebbe, etc. And it's an interesting shaila. I can't go into it now, and I often spoke about it, and believe it or not, a Talmud doing research found it in a Jewish newspaper from the 1880s, with Yerushalayim's Psak, and then when he corrected himself, etc. It really happened. I heard about this when I davened in the Bronx, in Arthur Avenue, Yeshivat Rabbeinu Chaim Moshe. The old timers would tell me about the Shiloh and the Psak, etc. So I'm riding on the 3rd Avenue L, and again, you got to remember that no one knew what was happening in Europe in 41, 42. The State Department kept it a big secret. The official Jewish community, which was in the hands of the Reform Rabbinate, went along with Roosevelt, went along with the State Department, not to harm the war effort. They never revealed what they knew. You got to give credit to Reb Lazer Silva. You got to give credit to Peter Berkson. They knew, made it public, went to work, Var Hatzalah, etc. By 43, you couldn't keep it a secret, and we all knew millions of Jews had been killed, tens of thousands being killed daily. And I remember my father was holding the New York Post, and the headlines were about what's going on, the genocide of the Jews, lo aleinu. And I said to my father, Daddy, how can we live a normal life if our brethren, our cousins, our brothers, our sisters are being killed daily just because they're Jews? And the very fact that I asked that question already reveals that this kid, as young as he is, he's starting to understand al hayamin vi al hasmal. Then I want to tell a third recollection. Can we help you? What are you looking for?
Laptop case?
Anyone see a black laptop case? I didn't see it when I walked in at 6. I was in the room ready 6:20. I didn't see it.
Yeah, okay,
I would generally notice, but okay. But come back later if you want to search on the floor. Yeah. Come back later.
Right.
Okay. So I want to reveal a third story that had an unbelievable impact on me, as you'll all decipher in a second. Here I was in, and I write about this too in Washington. Here I was in public school, first grade. And I told you I was a wild kid. I beat the teacher up, and the teacher had sent for my mother. And finally the teacher said she was a Jewish lady. I don't know if she was from, not from, if she knew anything about Yiddishkeit. I have no idea. I believe I give her name in Washington, because I had a report card with her name on it. I think it's Delaray, but anyway, you can check. And that lady has a big schut, as you can understand. And she says to my mother, you know, your kid is Jewish, you're Jewish, the class is a third Jewish, a third Irish, a third Italian. That was the neighborhood. And she says, he learns very quickly. What he learns in a day takes a week for the other kids to learn. And she suggested to my mother, I guess you wanted to get rid of me, or maybe, who knows, it was Mamasha Malach. She suggested to my mother, there's a yeshiva parochial school, the only one in the Bronx, a few blocks from my house. I lived at Washington 180th, the parochial school was 176th. And Webster was five, six little blocks away. So my mother switched me. Thomas Sora played a role in it. My parents had no extra money, and I think they arranged a tuition of $5 a month. I remember she called Thomas Sora, and Thomas Sora called Solanta. And I come to Solanta. And here I'm a kid, the second, third grade, comes 90, third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade. Comes 1947, November 29th, and I'll never forget the sight. The teachers are standing out in the hall. Our teachers, our morning teachers. I write up, please read Washington, understand Washington. Harry Merrillis wrote that what I described in Solanta was exactly what you had in Chicago. These teachers weren't from. These teachers were all maskilim Zionists. For whatever the reasons were, they didn't succeed in America selling insurance, so they taught in Solanta. They taught in the day school. Some of them might have been somewhat Shomer Shabbos. Some of them, but far from all. I don't want to mention names. Some had big yichas. Doesn't matter. And here the teachers are standing in the hall. A radio, a big radio, wasn't as big as a console. Now the radios were smaller, was plugged in, and the teachers are crying. crying, you know what that means to a little kid? You see teachers, mature teachers, crying. And it was the vote on the UN, the vote for partition, which meant there would be a Jewish state. Those of you who saw the letter that just surfaced that the Rav signed know what I'm talking about. It had an unbelievable impact. So you see, we grew up, we couldn't be pagans. We couldn't be self-centered. Adam Korovets, a lot small, played a very, very small role in our lives. We were Jews. There was Holocaust. There was a state. It had a tremendous impact. And these three people that I want to talk about were older than I am. They were at an age already where they could do, they could achieve. And all three had one dream after the Holocaust: to rebuild the Jewish people. Shoah v'tekuma. Death and life. We perished, but we created. These were three great individuals whose entire being was consumed by concern for the totality and the continued existence of God's people. This was the era, and these were people who responded, rose above the crowd. When I announced I'd be teaching about these individuals, so I received an email. It comes by way of yutorah.org. It's someone I don't know, but obviously a sub-student, Baruch Cohen. And I don't want to read the Rebbe, I am a long-time virtual student. Thank you for enlightening me on so many topics, from Erev to Aguna, etc. Because you will soon teach regarding the two personalities I list above, mainly Kahana and Kalbach, I would like to share some information. I was at Miri Yeshiva High School in 1969 when RMK, Reb Meir Kahana, was big. Quotes. At times when in the Beis Medrash I saw him stopping in for a word of the Shmuel Berenbaum, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. Many of my friends joined JDL and some even went to camp. I noticed that many of my JDL classmates often left after a while, and I wondered why these friends did not remain for long in JDL activities. In 1970, I made Aliyah. He writes in brackets, I live in Michigan now, to learn with Rav Gustman at Netzach Yisrael. I recall seeing you and your students because BMT was using a small pension right next to our yeshiva. That's absolutely right, in Rehob Ben Ezra. I would often see Reb Meir Kahana walking in Jerusalem. I asked Reb Meir why so many teachers joined with a fire in their belly and with a year they stopped and left the JTL. Reb Meir Kahana answered me, I wonder about that myself. I then asked my teacher of handwriting analysis, these are people who were very big in Jerusalem when I came in Aliyah, Rabbi Chaim Lifshitz, Olav Shalom, a French Hill, what he thought about the question. Rabbi Chaim Lifshitz answers, teenagers can be great idealists, but also have other passions, meeting girls, earning money to buy cars, planning their careers, sports, studying Torah, etc. And so their idealistic, fanatical stage does not last long. There was too much competition for their time. The next time I saw Reb Meir, I shared with him what Reb Chaim Lifshitz had answered. Reb Meir reflected for a moment and said the answer of Reb Chaim Lifshitz made sense to him. He seemed to appreciate this insight. And this is exactly the point I want to make. Anyone growing up during this period could not help but be affected. Holocaust and reconstruction, rebirth. But we get caught up in life. It's only the chosen few who rise above the crowd and their entire being is consumed by Holocaust and rebirth state of Israel. Reb Meir Kahane was one of them. Then he writes, regarding Reb Shlomo Kalbach, a new friend said to me in 1982, quote, "History will judge Reb Shlomo Kalbach as important a figure as the Baal Shem Tov," end quote. I almost laughed out loud, but I controlled myself as he was a new friend. After a few weeks, I began to think maybe my friend was right. Shabbos used to be so limited in Simcha, and the Shabbos davening was a soulless niggun for lechadodi and keladon. And post the Six-Day War, the Baal Tshuva movement, etc., perhaps my friend was right after all. By the way, I never saw Rav Shlomo Kalbach in a short-sleeved shirt. This observation concludes any photos or videos that I have watched at him. I think his yucky background is the reason. Thank you for all your Torah and Zionist teachings. And one second, hear his full name, Baruch Lazvnik. And I believe Yomo checked him out. He teaches in a day school. He's been involved in Chinuch for many years in the Michigan area. Now, that little letter is very powerful, very insightful. Reb Meir Kahane, kids joined him. They were called the Chayot that gathered around him. Some of them I taught later in BMT. Rough guys, tough guys, a different type of Jew. But right, later in life, they assimilated into the normal pattern like everyone else. Rav Shlomo Kalbach, a very controversial figure, as we will see until today. But I have to tell you, could very well be that 100 years from now, they'll say this man gave us a new revolution, a new soul to Yiddishkeit. I cannot believe all the books that have been published, all the Hasidic tales he has told, all the nigunim he wrote. There's a lot of truth to it. Okay? Now, on all these three individuals, their full-length biographies. I'll cite the material. But I'm not going to spend the year on each one. It's their lives, their life story is only as important as what they achieved. And I want to center in, focus on some of what did they really achieve? Who were they? What did they accomplish? Where did they really hit a Grand Slam home run? I'll also mention the difficulties, the questions. Certainly Rabbis Kalbach and Kahane are not free of controversy until today in the Torah world. I'm not interested in the paganistic world. Anyone who's a good Jew, immediately he will be dismissed by the paganistic world. But even in the Torah world, there is controversy. Now, I'll begin with Rav Shlomo because he was the eldest. And today I want to give you an outline of his life. And then I want to zero in on two aspects of his life. His education, I think it has a lot of food for thought for us. How do we educate? Do we confuse when we do too much, too different? Do we stick to one style, two styles? Kahane was exposed to three major trends. And not Kahane, Reb Shlomo Kalbach, to three major trends in his life. And we'll see, this perhaps can account who he was and what he became. I also want to deal with what I consider the most lasting and greatest achievement of Reb Shlomo, and the role he played in the refusenik community. Here I have a prejudice. I admit that having worked in communist Russia, having been involved in the heart of this problem, with the heart of the great minds in Israel dealing with it, so I have a certain prejudice, and my humble opinion, what he did for the Jews in Russia, he gave them life, he gave them a soul, it stands way above anything else in his life. And it could very well be that in the skut of that, the whole world today, acharei mot kedoshim, from Haredim to Tzioniyim to religious Zionists to the entire public thoroughfare, Reb Shlomo is accepted. But let me begin with his life. Now, I knew many Kalbachs. It's a very prominent German rabbinic family. Many brothers, many children, many sons. Many of them became rabbanim. This was not an unknown family. His years, to put him into context, 1925 to 1994. He was born in Berlin, where his father, Rabbi Naftali Kalbach, and there's an entire book written about his father. His father was a Rav in Berlin. He was a twin. He didn't come from a big family. He had a twin brother, Reb Eliachayim Kalbach, and I have to stress to you that I knew Reb Eliachayim intimately for one simple reason, and Dov will understand this. We rabbinated next to each other. Dov, I was in Maplewood, he was in Hillside. Are you aware of that? You remember the name? He was Reb Shlomo's twin brother. They were very different, very different. The Rav in Hillside was a tremendous Talmud Chacham regarding Hasidut. He published on Hasidic terms. He was not, when you met Rav Shlomo, you were shaking. His brother, and he had a terrific wife, Hadassah, from the Schneerson family. He was related to the Rebbe. He married into the Rebbe's family. Fabulous, fabulous couple, Hadassah and Eliachayim Kalbach. There was a sister, a younger sister, Shulamit, and Shulamit married very big Litvashi Yichis. She married the son of Rav Reuven Lubavitch, the famous Mira Yeshiva Mashkiach. She was a Lubavitch. So a very fascinating family. And Kalbach in his youth, by 1933, his parents already saw the writing on the wall. In 31, they left Germany. They went to Austria. 33, his father already was a Rav in Switzerland. In 38, the young Schleimela emigrated to Lithuania, studying in a yeshiva. We'll see all this in great detail later. Parents already went on to America, had a small shul on the Upper West Side, West 79th Street. It was called Congregation Kehilat Yaakov. And Kalbach joined his parents in 1939, reaching America via Great Britain. When his father died in 67, he and his brother Eliachayim jointly took over the shul. It was a family synagogue. Reb Eliachayim later moves on to Hillside, and Reb Shlomo, to a certain degree, back and forth from Los Angeles, from Israel, remained active in the shul. Now, when he comes to America, this is most fascinating. First, he goes to Torah Vadas. Torah Vadas at the time had Rav Shlomo Hyman. As I mentioned in my lectures on Torah Vadas, Rav Shlomo Hyman was brought to America to be a counterweight to Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. once what becomes Yeshiva University had a first-rate Rosh Yeshiva, Teira Vadas was not going to survive with top students if they didn't have someone who could match up with Reb Moshe. And Reb Shlomo Hyman was a Talmud Mufak of Reb Baruch Be'alevovich. He was an Adam Gadol. Talmidim gathered around him B'dechilu Rechimu. He raised the Reb Avram Pam, many others, Gedolei Yisrael. And Reb Shlomo started in Teira Vadas. Then Reb Aaron Cutler arrived in America in 1941. Reb Aaron Cutler already had a sterling reputation, Klipska Rosh Yeshiva. His first 2 years in America, he threw himself into Hatzalah work 100%. It is to Reb Lazer Silva's credit, Reb Lazer organized Var Hatzalah, but when Reb Aaron came, went into it, Reb Lazer stood aside. Reb Aaron was Reb Aaron. His word was the final word. By 1943, Reb Aaron realized you can't save another Jew. I just want to say one thing. Talmud walked in from the old country. I just want to mention to you, a Talmud's going to walk back into the classroom with his breakfast. You are related. You'll find out after class. It's the same name, and his father told him in communist Russia that anyone who has that last name, we are family. By 1943, Reb Aaron realized you could not save one more Jew. Everything was lost. And that's, of course, where Reb Aaron takes over what had begun in White Plains with Reb Mendel Sachs. He takes it out to Lakewood, and Lakewood is on the map. Reb Shlaimala goes to Lakewood, and he's one of Reb Aaron's top talmidim. His mother always dreamt that he would be the Talmud Chacham. They considered him the brightest in the family, more than his brother, more than his sister. He's learning by Reb Baron, he learned by Reb Shlomo Hyman, and they are overjoyed he's learning in Lakewood. But what's fascinating about Reb Shlomo, his mind never was satisfied. And while this is going on, he comes to New York, he's helping his father, he sets up in 1950 a small little learning group which he calls Tasgik, T-S-G-G, Taste and See God is Good, T-S-G-G, pronounced Tasgik. So you see, and by the way, he doesn't know English yet. His English is a broken English. His native language is German. He knows Yiddish. He was in Lithuania. His English is very poor yet. He starts taking a Hebrew language class at the Jewish Theological Seminary. Now, this is very important. I got an email. I might mention it later. People have to realize that in the early 50s, JTS was still nominally committed to Jewish law. So it was not strange that someone who had learned in Lakewood would go over to JTS, the Upper West Side, not far from the shul actually, one subway ride, not that far. He and his father went there to study Hebrew. Now, when he came to JTS, I don't know if it was in the library, in the hallway, in the lounge, probably in the student lounge, there was a piano. So, Yosef Mordechai Gachman, there was a piano. And he went over to the piano and started playing. And a lady heard him play. And she saw this guy has musical ability. And her name, Sarah Scheffler Kelman. She marries into the Kelman family afterwards, or she was a Kelman. And she invited Kalbach to sing Hasidic tunes at the Hillel Center and Covent Avenue. A little nothing. And he was doubtful should he accept it, but all right, she pestered him, and she put up a poster for the event entitled, quote, "The Place of Music in the Hasidic Tradition." This was Kalbach's first public performance. Years later, whenever he met Scheffler Kelman, he would say to her, "You gave me the title for my life's work." And it's fascinating. Lakewood, JTS, a piano recital. Who knows how many people came? And the place of music in the Hasidic tradition, "You gave me the title for my life's work." All right, in 1951, as I mentioned, he didn't know English yet. He began learning English at a special program at Columbia University. Until then, he generally conversed in Yiddish. Becoming fluent in English only at the age of 26, he developed an unusual grammar, mixing Yiddish and English, that became his hallmark, and later influenced the language of his followers as well as many other members of the Neo-Hasidic movement. And this takes us to any of us who grew up in a yeshiva. Do we speak English or do we speak English? And all of us know that there are words in Yiddish that would creep into our vocabulary. It was, I would say, as natural as breathing air. The only exception to the rule is Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik. Ugh, what Danny Greer did to us. And here I share you again with the story. And not everyone knows it, I have to tell you. Don't want to mention the name, but people who are as close to Rav Soloveitchik in any way possible, including relationship, they came to hear the story from me. Everyone has it without the full tune details. But I can't help but know the details because the Rav was sitting where I'm sitting and I was sitting here. And in 1960, September, after the first year, Danny Greer comes over to the Rav. "Rebbe, you are stopping Jewish children from learning Torah." And the Rav jumps up. What do you mean? And he says, "I graduated Princeton. I'm taking off the year I want to learn. And I don't understand Yiddish." And the Rav says, "All right, tomorrow the shiur will be in English. And I'll give you a bechina after the shiur." And the next day we come in, this was Tuesday, Wednesday we come in, and the Rav gives the entire shiur in English. Not one trace of Yinglish. Everyone, Reb Chaim, the Chetza, the Gavra, the Shnei Dinim, everything in the Rav's English. We had trouble understanding him. Pshuto k'mashma'o. And Abba, if you're listening to the shiur, if you'll pick it up in YU Torah, Abba's a Talmud of Braunschweigel. If you're listening to the shiur of Abba Braunschweigel, believe me, he was so upset, you have no idea. How can you learn Torah not in Yiddish? He was a survivor, he came from Gerich Sidim. His grandfather was the Melamed Dardaki of the Re'ein, Reb Avraham Mordechai, the great third Gerer Rebbe. And it with the Rav, English was English, Yiddish was Yiddish. No Yinglish involved. But you all know this is Reb Schleimler, all the stories, all the recordings. Yomo gave me a recording to listen to of Reb Schleimler, which I told Yomo, never ever mention to me you're a Haredi Jew. Because on that recording, Reb Schleimler, wow, like any good religious Zionist, castigates the rebbeim of the 1930s and the earlier period, not allowing Jews to go in Aliyah. We've spoken about this many times in the Sakhmurad, and when he visited Kiryat HaYovel, and the head of police, you know the story. And there's Shlomo Le Kalbach, but it's in Yinglish, not in English, not in Yiddish. Now, but that's part of his charm. That was part of his charm. Here's a man who learned English at the age of 26. You got to give credit. German, Yiddish, English, Hebrew. Okay. Now, at this point, Lubavitch is blossoming. And again, it's all part of this tremendous explosion that takes place following World War II. Reb Aaron is in America, you have Lakewood. Chaim Berlin already was Reb Yitzchak Kutner. Teira Vidas, Mr. Mendelovich. And now you have Lubavitch, the sixth Lubavitch Rebbe, and the sixth Lubavitch Rebbe who dies in 1950. And you all remember my lectures. It took a whole year until they finally reached a majority decision that the youngest son-in-law will take over, Reb Menachem Mendel. And Reb Shlomele can't stop seeking, searching. And he comes to Lubavitch. And here, of course, the Rebbe understood this is a man of tremendous talent. The Rebbe actually, I don't know historically if we can say, the first shluchim that the Rebbe sent out to the college campuses was Shlomo Le Kalbach and his chaver, Zalman Schechter Shlomi, who died recently, it's in the last year or two. And they went out to the college campuses. Each one later goes his own way. Shlomo Le Kalbach becomes Shlomo Le Kalbach. And the Lubavitch Rebbe was not happy with him. We've all spoken about it many times. His outreach, his singing, his men and women together. The Rebbe said you have to keep separate. And that sort of forced Reb Shlomele to leave Chabad. He said, if I would have insisted on men and women being separate, he says one or two people would have come and they were crazy for coming. Why should they come? But when you have men and women together, you get a crowd already and I can do my show. The story with Zalman Schechter Shlomi is a lot sadder. He went out and became a god unto himself, an idol unto himself, and invented a whole new religion, although he remained Jewish, but far from Tavah Hashem, Zu Halacha. I don't have to go into details. Now, Kalbach, on a personal level, had many difficulties. And here, not all of us walk the straight path in life. I have a grandson who always would say to me, you were lucky you met Safta, you met Gran in Bnei Akiva. And to us, growing up at that time, that was very, very normal. Boys and girls, Bnei Akiva, I'm looking at Yitz Rubin, I remember his first wife, Judy, also a childhood sweetheart from Bnei Akiva. And we had no trouble meeting, marrying, to death do we part. We worked out very happy family lives, etc., etc. I can give you hundreds, if not thousands, of examples. If you grow up in a Hasidic world, again, there's no concept of meeting a girl or falling in love. We believe we marry the girl we love. They say we love the girl we marry. There's a very fine difference there. You make a shidduch. And I have to tell you, although I come from the kippah srugah world, the Hasidic way is not bad at all. I remember the Rav and the talk he gave on sex and marriage, where he's telling about how his grandmother was playing with her dolls, and his mother, Rebbetzin Pesha, walked in and said to her, Gutta, Gutta, Mazel Tov, you're a kala. And that's how she found out she was engaged to Rebbe Prujana. Tovis, named for Gutta, means good. And the Rebbe's daughter is Tovis, named for his grandmother, named for Gutta, her great-grandmother. And the Rev sat him down, and he looked at the audience and said, and I want you to know, they worked out an unbelievable happy marriage a lot better than you do with your dating, etc. And it's true, they were very devoted to each other, married for, what was it, more than 60 years, on to 70 years, kanayin hara. All right? That's the normal fashion. But you see, Reb Shlaimala bounced around all these different influences and had trouble settling down, had trouble finding a wife. He finally married Elaine Ne'ila Glick. They had two daughters, Nidara, known as Dari, Neshama. The marriage did not survive the passage of time, but they remained friendly. Also, a comment on life. And Dari is totally integrated. She lives in Israel and totally at home, fine family. His daughter Neshama is in her father's traditions, a singer. She was involved in the Reform movement. Honored her suddenly. Reform was blessed. I don't want to go further. There are two tremendous influences on every last one of us, Simcha, a paganistic influence and a Torah influence. And we have to struggle to come out of it on the right side. Kalbach got involved with at that time, the 1960s, and Bob Dylan, Peter Seeger, other folk singers, Berklee Folk Festival, 1966, and he starts to see the youth in the 1960s already. He remained in the San Francisco area. He opened up the House of Love and Prayer. A lot has been written about it, a lot has been described about it. Drugs, hillbillies, yes from yes dedicated, not dedicated. Six-Day War came along and Israel becomes the center of everyone's attention, and Kalbach slowly but surely switches his influence to Israel, opens up a moshav, Ma'or Modiin, a moshav that's in existence until today, and he winds up traveling all over the world. Everyone wants to hear Kalbach. The man was totally selfless. When he died, money had to be collected to arrange his funeral. If someone came over to him, he gave away every cent in his pocket. That's about Gedolei Yisrael. I write about Reb Lazer Silva. The shul stopped paying him his salary. They would give it to his wife. Because if they gave him the money and he was walking home and some person had to make a wedding and came over to him with a tale of woe, he gave away every cent in his pocket. Shlaimel Kalbach was like that. He went back and forth. He's in America, he's in Russia, he's in Israel, he's all over Canada, singing, performing. He became a legend in his lifetime. What was it like? So I can tell you, halacha lemaisa, we bought our apartment in 1969 in Rehov Rav Chaim, Berlin. We moved in Pesach, we were in the absorption center until Pesach, right? We moved in about 2 weeks before Pesach, 1970. We were very close to BMT, where BMT began, an easy walk, Rehov Ababonel, Rehov Ibn Ezra. Summer of 1970, Kalbach rented an apartment in 16 Berlin, right next door. And my wife, loving Kalbach Nigunim, you have to take me. Saturday night, we got to go to the Kumsitz. We see the youth coming in. We go in. We were young, too. And what can I tell you? It was a psychedelic experience. There's either it's incense that they're burning, a long Havdalah candle, or it's drugs. What a smell. And there's Kalbach and the youth around him. Some look with it, some look spaced out. But he was their Rebbe. He reached out and he had influence. And he made many people from many people conscious of their Judaism, gave many people encouragements, developed the technique of the Hasidic story. I need not tell you Breslov, the stories of Reb Nachman and Reb Shlomo, from all the Hasidic tell, the Babich story, Abel's story, the Holy Brothers, a book was just given out in Torah Shraga, and he became Shleimela, one of a kind. Now, let me go one step further, and this is very important. Following his death, a great deal of criticism was leveled at him for irresponsible sexual behavior. There are two books written on Kalbach's life. One is by Chaim Dalfin. I cited this years ago when I spoke about Kalbach in a different context. And one is basically like a doctor, like a PhD thesis. It may have been his thesis or it's after his thesis. It's someone I know from the time he was 3 years old. His brother or sister, they were all my students. His brother was a BMT boy. And the book on Kalbach and Nathan Oppenheimer, Nathan Ophir is Nathan Oppenheimer to begin with. Like Amani Rothkopf, Aaron Rakefet, he is Nathan Ophir today. His work on Kalbach is fabulous. It's been published in English, published in Hebrew, translated into Hebrew. He more or less presents the problem, but leaves it for future generations to decide. Chaim Dalfin actually interviews some of the ladies. I have to tell you, Nafla B'Yadayim Shali, it fell into my hands, someone I'm related to by marriage, and she tells me of her relationship with Kalbach. And this, there was a famous article in Lilith magazine that after he died, and Lilith in general, I know the original editor was a classmate of my wife, or in Ramaz a year behind her, don't want to mention her name, but a hatred for men. And part of the Me Too generation, this is a big problem, because a woman can say whatever she wants, and generally they believe her. Sometimes it's her imagination. It's not real. All right, it's a real problem if you follow the current scene, you know what I'm talking about. So what seems to come from all these complaints, and this I heard from family relative, with no reason, it was told to me 30 years after it happened, he would call her in the middle of the night, what type of clothes are you wearing? What are you wearing? What are you dressed? And this is, it's not proper behavior. Right? Yes, Simcha. I haven't said anything yet, but go ahead. Okay, it's not proper behavior. All right. Never was there a charge made that he raped someone or seduced someone physically, but not proper behavior. The other hand, I want to raise, and I believe it's Affenbacher, Ophir, tells the story. And I've dealt with this halachically, the Rav had to deal with it. I want to ask you a question. You're a psychologist, psychiatrist. A teenage kid comes to you for help. Okay? More important than anything you do is putting your hand around that kid and giving him encouragement and telling him you love him, you accept him for what he is. Right or wrong? You've studied psychology or not? Take a Rebbe. I taught men, I taught women. With men I have a relationship until today. The kids I taught in the 60s are my greatest talmidim. I told the story of Shuas. Did I tell it in class or not? Shavuos night, the only early minyan in my area was an old rifka. Noach, it was at the 508. At the minyan, a mob scene. And I'm davening with students, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, in every school I ever taught. And they mob me afterwards, and the student from 65, 64, 65, I'll mention his name, Dr. Avi Freilich, he gives back the shiur I gave Monday before Shavuot, word by word. I mean, you understand that relationship? Why? Because these were younger kids, and I could put my hand around their shoulder. There's one kid, I just called him this morning, left him a message, one kid. He's the world famous rabbi, doctor, postdoctoral research. This kid was 14, 15 when he was my Talmud. I said, you're going to be a great Talmud. Put my hand, gave him encouragement. Tell me, I taught women for 31 years. Did I ever put my hand around the woman that I taught? Maybe a teenager. Well, they weren't so teenage, let's say. The youngest would be 8, 17, 18. Maybe some of them, no, God, it's a woman. Keep your distance, right or wrong. Now, what about if you're a psychiatrist? You're a psychologist. The Rav was asked this question, that part of the help that you can give to a 15-year-old girl, she never had love from her parents. I mean, you know what goes on in life. Most parents are normal. But there are people who are incapable of showing love. And this girl, her therapist, oh, what he did for me. Tell me, you're allowed to put your hand around the girl? We'll cover, by the way, we're going to come to this in the Sunday class when I'm dealing with lifting up a Jewish woman who fainted. We're going to deal with this very problem, a medical doctor, woman, pulse, etc. Now, this is a very different, this is a riot. This is not a question in Yontif Sheni. Yontif Sheni, whatever you do, you can't be wrong. You know what I say. When people ask me for Psalm, I'm not on I'm a Haaretz, but on Yontif Sheni, there's nothing you can tell me that I don't know. Believe me. So people ask me for Yontif Sheni. I say to them, do you want me to give you a psak, or do you want me to give you sources to justify what you're going to do? You can't have this. This is a riot. This may be the according to you've studied according to the Rambam and Isidia writer, not the Rabbanim. At least you mean the Lotik Ram, Machloikis, the Rambam, the Ramban. All right. It's a very delicate question. I don't know if the Rav ever paskin. These are questions that you don't want to paskin. So now let me tell you a story. And I told this story years ago in a different context. It's a very powerful story. I believe it's written up by Natan Ophir. Shlomo was supposed to give a lecture, give a performance on one of the big shuls in Manhattan. Get a heavy fee for it. And the Rav was out of town, and he comes back, arrives at Grand Central, and he's moving, walking through Grand Central, and there he sees Kalbach sitting in a corner with his arm around a young lady. The rabbi was hysterical, canceled Kalbach the next morning. Okay, you just heard a story. What would you do, Yomo? Now, the inside story. This girl became through Kalbach. The girl lived in upstate New York. The girl came down with a very aggressive form of cancer. She was told she had a few months left to live. She came to see her Rebbe and cry on his shoulders. That's Shlomo look, his hand around her. She's in tears. So you see, you're coming here into a very difficult human challenge. Halacha, Dvar Hashem, human tragedy, B'li Taiva, perhaps. Not easy, not easy to totally rule Shlomo out. He did in public, and this I saw with my own eyes, brother, sister, everyone got a kiss from him. If you didn't get a kiss, he patted you on the shoulder at least. No, are you allowed to do that? And Kalbach admitted in public time and again that perhaps his behavior was not correct, was not totally halachic, didn't justify it, but like he was caught in a web. It's very difficult. You ask me 20 years ago, 30 years ago, I would have ruled Kalbach out. I would have never believed 20, 30 years after his death, his image is conquering the entire Torah world. Just this past Friday night, the shul I was davening in with an early minyan, which I helped establish a year ago. It's a whole story. We resuscitated some minyanim in Ohel Aron on Rehov Chalap. We had a Kalbach davening. A Rav who had been in England many years, product of Gateshead. I said to him after davening, Rav Yaakov, I think you enjoy more being a Shliach Tzibor than giving a drasha. And with that davening, you should have seen the black hats in the shul, the Kalbach minyanim, and they're shaking and dancing. And you see, what I believe has happened here, and I come back to my halachic sheyurim. Remember, I've said time and again, and this is the Kuntres Hashach in Yoredeya, had a paskin halacha. Ultimately, you have machloket right down the line. Outside of something that's clearly the oraita, on any rabbinic issue you can bring up, there are various viewpoints. How do you paskin? And that's the Gemara in Bracha Daf Mem Daled Amud Bet Mem Hey Omer Aleph Fuk Chazi Mai Ama Devar. It's four times in Shas. Go out and see what the people do. And it's like Klal Yisrael has a special chush, a special ability when they reach a decision, Shahakol before the water and Bari Nefashet after the water, that is what every Jew should be doing. It's the Gemara in Pesachim. Famous Gemara with Hillel HaZaken. What do you do if you forgot to bring the knife to the Beit HaMikdash and you have to shech the Korban Pesach Shabbat afternoon, b'moado? Remember? And he said, I don't know. Forgot the halacha. Chazal say, because he said he could answer any shaila. So they showed him no one is big enough to answer any shaila. And the Gemara says, he says, Smoch al b'nei Yisrael. I believe it's Samech Vav Amir Aleph from Pesachim. Smoch al b'nei Yisrael. Nu, help me out. Im lo nevi'im heim, b'nei nevi'im heim. It's a very powerful Gemara. And then he saw the next day how they put it into the sheep, into his ear, the wool. And, Ra'am Ma'aseh v'nizka halacha. That's taka the tradition. So, you see, with Kalbach, let me put it this way. No one will say that Shechta Shlomi is accepted today. He pushed himself out of Klal Yisrael. You'll take Solomon Schechter and Catholic Israel that began the whole conservative movement. No one will say today that Solomon Schechter was a proper Orthodox Jew. He was Orthodox prax, but not Orthodox in theology. No one today will push Kalbach away. And it doesn't mean we whitewash him. His daughter, there's a quote here from his daughter, which is very powerful. His daughter Neshama wrote an open letter to the women who were harmed by Kalbach. She wrote, quote, "I accept the fullness of who my father was, flaws and all. I am angry with him, and I refuse to see his faults as the totality of who he was." That's a very powerful, insightful comment. And you can't get away from it. Kalbach is all over the place. Religious Zionist camps, so you'll say, all right, they're not that frum. The Hasidic world, you'll say, all right, they're Hasidim, they daven shelo bizman, they have other sins, so they have this sin too. But the Litvishe Welt, Kalbach Minyanim, Kalbach Nigunim, wherever you go. So I think we have to learn from this. Halavai, your sexual life should flow smoothly. There's a time to meet a girl. There's a time to get married. There's a time to have children. Unfortunately, in the world today, the paganistic world, there's so much happening. People marry, Shomer Shabbos people don't want to have children. They tell you, we don't want to bring children into this world. Well, how are we going to have Jews tomorrow if you don't have children? The world today, men and women are equal. Is it good? Is it bad? I have my doubts if it's totally good. Women have careers. Why marry? They don't have the same hormones that a man has. And then you have another problem. Women by nature are more mature than men, have more insight than men. The Gemara says, the Gemara neither, Bina Yatira Banashim. So you set them up. I had this where a girl spat in my face, a Talmida, I set her up with a boy, and then she laughs in my face with the boy standing there. Him! What's wrong with him? All right, it's not as mature as you are. I'll never forget that. I felt so bad. For him, I felt bad. She's an idiot. The girl looks at the boy, halfwit compared to me. Yeah, it's very true. Every gadol b'Yisrael would tell you, I owe everything to my wife. Didn't Rabbi Akiva say, Shaliva Shalah, Shalahu. Read memoir literature. Read biographies of Gedolei Yisrael. The Rav, Moriah Rebbe, I write about it. When we wanted to get someone to tell him off, we went to his wife. Remember what happened with Shakran? It's legendary, but I was there, I saw it, I heard it, and anyone in that class remembers what went on? What pressure, young kids. Yada, lo yada. Shakran, you raised your hand, you didn't know. We cried to the Rebbetzin. All right, the next week we come into class, we're all sitting with our heads down, and we didn't know what an bomb would land. And the Rebbe says, you're a bunch of crybabies. And we all laughed, but he never pulled the Shakran again. You follow? Says the Rebbetzin, Rabbi Moshe's wife, go right down the line. Rabbi Aaron Cutler's wife, daughter of Rabbi Yisrael Zalman Meltzer. Bainu Shalom. So I have to say, on that level, Kalbach, I can understand it was not easy for him. We'll see next week. There were so many different influences on his youth. I don't know, or let me put it this way. Very few people can say they were totally exposed to the German traditions, Torah Derech Eretz, totally exposed to Lithuania, both in Litter, as we will see, and then in America, and then Hasidus. And it was not easy for him. I can understand where he was busy gaining all this knowledge and trying to learn English as well. Don't forget that. And these were the golden years where he should have married. And that problem I don't deny. Someone asked me yesterday, I can tell you who, Stephanie Strauss asked me, the lady, my dear Talmidah, who runs Gruss, the legal signature. And she asked me, will you cover the child? I said, absolutely. Can't talk about Kalbach by not mentioning there's a whole website until today where people write in stories. But if you look at all the stories, you'll see the common thread that it was not strange, overwhelming physical contact. It was more a psychological, emotional contact. And 30 years ago, I would have been more negative, because I'm an ish halacha. But in the year 2022, Klal Yisrael has spoken, has ruled. Now, I want to add one postscript before I end off. And this is crucially important. It comes up in YU and the so-called scandals. You know, you can put your arm around the girl and say, well, there was totally no type and no this, no that. I did it to encourage her. I did it because her father never did it for her. But you got to remember, that's what you think. You don't know what she's thinking. And this is crucially important. With YU, people may have had good intentions, but the student misinterprets it. And you can't forget that. It takes two to tango. You can look at yourself, but you can't put yourself into someone else's mind. And I've gotten to Shaila many, many times. I have never been Matea. I don't know what to do. I say, go ask some other posek. I can't bring myself Lahatir, because Dinei Nefoshet, it's Dinei Arayot. You're dealing here with fire, with water, with gasoline. I should say fire and gasoline, leave out the water. You may think it's water, she may think it's gasoline. And this problem, this is why I would be very, very happy if the Rabbinical Council of America would issue an ISA that no rabbi should advise a woman in the world today, when the paganistic society rules us, on any matter that she comes to him, any internal matter, any matter of life, of emotion, marriage, etc., women have to handle it. And the same with seminaries. I'll be the happiest person alive when we achieve that in every seminary, all the teachers, all the way up to the dean included, are women. At one time, we had no women role models. Today, you have more and more. But women for women, men for men, that's the halacha. That's it. Look into Hilchat Talmud Torah. You'll know what I'm talking about. This is the way we should live. A man is a man and a woman is a woman. And we're not living in the paganistic societies where, God have mercy, no men, no women, freedom of choice. How were you born? My sister-in-law just told my wife's sister, she had to file a form for her corona shot, and they wanted to know, what sex were you born? And she wrote down, I refuse to answer. Disgrace. to human dignity, to the divine soul that is within us. Okay, so this is the way I view Karl Bach. In a 50 years from now, tell me whether I'm right or wrong, but Klal Yisrael has overlooked the problems on this level and accepted him with, I would say, open arms. Okay. Any questions? Simcha, put the brick down. What did you want to say?
I have a friend who is a
Chazan. Is a what?
Chazan. And he said there was something about the nature of the working in music which loaned itself to problems with power and like attraction. I wanted to know if there...
Okay, so I want to tell you, you know how much research has been done on that topic. I don't know about music, but I'll answer you with something that keeps you thinking. What field are you in? What do you have a degree in?
Writing.
Writing, okay. You're in my world. Interesting. But I thought of it in psychology. You know what research has been done with second generation survivors? Okay? Now, let me give you an example of what we're talking about. Zev, are you second generation? Your parents? No. Anyone here? Noah?
My parents.
You're second generation or your parents are?
Parents.
Your parents, you're third generation. Let me tell you a little story. Bring it to life. I know this family, I don't want to mention names. Survivors went through hell. Tremendous yichus, came to America. Did okay. Four children married from people, boy, girl, girl, boy. All four got divorced and married a second time. Second time around, money. Nothing else mattered. They say that people who survived and went through Hitler, subconsciously, they want guarantees that they'll have power, that no one can step on them. Reflects in the story I just told you. Sexual drive, also power. You seduce women. I'm powerful. I heard one story, I'm sick to repeat this, but a Talmud of mine was divorced. He's gone out with many girls. He remarried briefly. I think he's given up trying to remarry. So he goes out with this girl, originally origins, Upper West Side. Second generation, parents, survivors, her father, this woman, that woman, and the mother says to the daughter, that's the way men are. They think they're powerful when they can seduce women. And that's a second generation trend. I don't know if it shows up in the third generation, but you'll find a lot written about this. It goes right down the line, but it reflects mainly in money and sex. So what you're saying, I don't know whether you say Hasidic music, but you got to look at the general picture, who you're coming from, where you're coming from. But coming back to Karl Bach, if there would have been charges that could be proven, and would have been proven, obviously, that there was actually real sexual contact, it's a horse of a different color. But Karl Bach viewed it, yeah, when I put my hand around, it's like, we'll talk about this in the Sunday class, B'li Taiva, the Rambam, you understand what I'm saying? Hilchot Isuri Bia. He was a boy, a girl. Yeah, that's very nice. I can say the same thing. But what does the girl think? What does the boy think? I don't want to go into details with why you. I know the person involved. I love that person. I know him from the 1940s on. I know him to be a tzaddik. I know things that he and his wife have done. I don't know nicer, finer, better people. On the other hand, physical contact. He's doing it to show he's one of the boys. And the kid walks away. Understand? You got to be very careful. I'll end off, let me just tell you something I say, and there's a lot of truth to this. I have taught on every level. I began teaching in 1959, Talmud Torah Elementary School. 62, I'm appointed a Rosh Yeshiva, YU, Dr. Belkin, etc. But in reality, I was a Rebbe in MTA, what becomes MTA, because the yeshiva was always part of one yeshiva. Then it splits when First Hall opens, because it becomes much bigger. Now I'm teaching high school kids. Later, I teach Zev. He's a college kid, BMT. Here, sitting in front of me, these are people, among them my students. I got a letter from one of these students. He's been studying me 30 years. He says it's nowhere near enough. He wants 40, 50. These are 40, 50, 30 years, 20 years, etc. Postgraduate. The greatest problem is teaching high school kids. Why? Because high school kids, that's the age they're shaping their life. It's much more than college and much more than elementary. It's the most formative years of your life. Teenage, high school kid. So he looks at the Rebbe. The Rebbe, yeah, he's a great tzaddik. Who can be like him? One of the greatest challenges to a Rebbe, and this is an MTA and in Torah Vadas and in Satmar and in Gai. I once spoke with Noach, a Rebbe in Satmar, the same thing. You got to show the kid you know his world. You grew up in his world. So, each one wants to show the kid a different way. I would never do it by physical contact. How did I show the kids? My baseball knowledge floored them. Oh, boy. Yesterday I spoke about Lou Gehrig, the 80th anniversary. Listen to what I said yesterday at the post-cheer. But these kids would walk out of there. Wow, the Rebbe, one of the boys, what he knows about DiMaggio and Hendrick and Keller and Gehrig and Lazzari and Ruth and Earl Combs and Bob Usual, oh my gosh, and Hank Greenberg and Stan Usual and Ted Williams, all the names I mentioned, take Stan Usual and put his picture up. He got married young, had a wonderful life, honest wife, children, good career, good St. Louis citizen. He was one of a kind, Stan Usual. You follow? DiMaggio was half this, half a bum. DiMaggio's greatest credit, he only trusted Jews. That's his credit. Kol hakavod to Joe D. But Rabbanu Shalom. Anyway, that's you see, but to put your hand around a girl and Kalbach, anyone walking in, holy sister, holy brother, all right? It troubled my halachic conscience. B'lit taiva, that's what you say. What does she say? What does the Ribbono Shel Olam say? It's a very delicate issue. But with Kalbach, I have to say, 30 years later, Lo Neviim Heim B'nei Neviim, Rakefet has to bow to the inherent knowledge, instinct, Torah soul of the beautiful people that I am part of, the Torah people, period. Gentlemen, to reiterate, I'm sorry, I ran out of time, just relax. Zev, yeah, do you want to say something?
No, I have to pick up my wife.
You have to pick up, then get the heck out of here, because I have more. I'm going to give out gifts in a minute. I
don't know the one thing that Rebbe holds against me is that I'm a Mets fan.
No, I'll be a Mets fan. The way the Yankees are doing well. I'm going to give out gifts in one minute.
I have to do this because...
One second, I stay here for the gifts. I have something very valuable.
Hold on. So Normie's not going to believe that I came to this year.
Normie's not going to believe it. Yeah, how is Normie? How is Normie?
Let's see.
It's one of our great characters who was one of the Chayot from Meir Kahana, what I spoke about an hour ago.
I don't know. All right.
You got it? Not Yomo can take a picture. Yeah, so take with me 1 second.
All right.
Yomo.
Yeah.
Noah.
Thank you.
We'll have a Satma picture. We'll have a YU Satma picture. Noah, don't forget, you're going back. Do great work. Do great work. Great.
Rebbe, wonderful seeing you.
Say another minute, it'll be worth your while.
She's already yelling at me. I guess I know. Sorry.
You have it?
Yeah.
How do you have it?
Yeah, last time we were here.
This picture just surfaced now, last time. Okay, anyway, what did we do today? Baruch Hashem, we finished our Torah Mesorah. We started Shlomo LeKalbach. I did a brief survey of his life, and I dealt with a very delicate issue. I have no other way of dealing with it. If you have a different take on it, let me know. But I think this is really Reb Shlomo and Klal Yisrael, and they have accepted him today with open arms. Be'ezrat Hashem, next week will be the final two lectures of the semester. Sunday I continue where I left off, and we're in the middle of a very fascinating question in Tshuva and the Rambam. And Monday we'll continue with Shlomo, and maybe we can sail into Meir as well, but these are people who wanted to change the world, and to a certain degree they did. Noach, can you turn off the... who's with me? Who can unmute the people who want to ask questions? Yomo began the shiur in Shmon Esrei, and he's benching now, so I got to depend upon Reb Noach here. This is a Jew. Do you see him? Show your face. This is a Jew who wears a shtreimel on Shabbos. So be aware, and we're very proud of it. Are you unmuting? How do we do it? Yomo, we need you here. Yomo's running up.
Nothing without Yomo.
Nothing without Yomo. Okay, who wants to ask? Someone's wanted to ask. I saw a hand up. Anybody? Yeah, one second.
Once when I was in Berkeley, actually, I asked someone about the House of Love and Prayer, and they had been part of it at that time. At the Levaya, I was standing next to Robinson Young Rice out on 79th Street because it was outside. There wasn't room inside. I'm a Kohen anyway.
Right.
But I was able to be there. We were Nachem Avo at his sister in Muncie, whom you mentioned.
Uh-huh.
I remember she was speaking about the Shlaushim coming up.
The Shlaushim.
And Hadassah moved, Rav Eli Zalmana moved to Crown Heights after he was Nifter.
To be near the Schneerson family, I gather.
Right.
Okay.
And her kids were over there, I think. What you mentioned about the Third Avenue L, there was a similar Shaila with the Rav on the T, the red line outbound, after Kenmore Square in Boston, where apparently the Rav was matir in some situations, possibly for Bikur Cholim, on Yantiv Sheni, something like that. I don't know the details, but there was a Shaila years ago on that.
Very
it
interesting.
It used to be free outbound after Kenmore Square.
Uh-huh. Interesting. I don't know. That you'd have to bring proof because the Rav to the
Matir. We'll ask Mendy Gopin.
Okay, that's...
Rebbe?
Sure.
Rebbe, can I ask a question?
Yeah, wait, one second. Who's speaking? Brian Thor. Go ahead. Brian?
Hi, Rebbe. Yes, two things. Rebbe, I did come in a little bit late, so I don't know if you mentioned about the fact that Shlomo was very much involved in the Soviet Jewry movement.
Next week's year is devoted to that.
Okay, because I just obviously...
I said that. Next week I want to do that.
One of the things that Rebbe mentioned about the davening, which is really true, but also when it comes to all the music of all the simple music of the Bedekian and all the simchas, every song, that's Karbach, that's Karbach, that's
right,
Karbach.
Right, right.
You know, I don't really know what they sang. I'm trying to figure out, what did they play at a wedding before Karbach came about? Like, the klezmer? Like, what was there? Like, what did they do?
Hava Nagila.
I don't know what they did.
Hava Nagila.
Karbach. Mazel Tov? Yeah. What do they
say? Simchat Mazel Tov was written in 66 when the Belzer Rebbe, present Belzer Rebbe, married at the age of 18.
Okay, so even Simchat Mazel Tov wasn't there. What did they sing before
You're not listening. Hava Nagila.
That's it?
Yeah, well, I'm saying it facetiously. That was already, Hava Nagila was already the most popular song, and compared to Kalbach, it doesn't hold a candle.
I wanted to add something else about the, Shlomo Kalbach. When I was in your shir in Gruss, in my second year in Gruss, and that was my first year of marriage, we went to the OU Center for Shlomo Kalbach concert. I had a very close relationship with Shlomo because I was the director at Lincoln Square Synagogue. And so I would walk over on Friday nights and either after the onegs or before the onegs or Motzei Shabbos, especially Simchas Torah, I had, you know, I had a lot of time and I got to meet Shlomo Kalbach. Of course, when I was at OZ on the West Side, we had a very, very special Shabbos with Shlomo at OZ, where he led davening instead of at his shul. He brought his whole shul to davening OZ. But there was a time that I was in Gruss when he, I saw him coming towards me and my then wife, Dvorah, and with open arms to come and give us both hugs. And of course, I stood right in between me and my wife because that's not happening on my watch. But I also felt that I agree with you, Rabbi. I did not feel, at least again, from a guy's perspective, I didn't see that he was coming from a sexual perverted nitiya. It was coming from, it was wrong. And listen, we all know that people do things that are wrong, but I don't think it was coming from a wrong place.
Right. Well, that's what he claims. And the story I told you, I think it's from Offenbacher, with that girl dying of cancer. She died a few weeks later. That story gives you the whole dilemma right in front of your eyes. In the halakhic context, we spoke about Reb Moshe wrote a tshuva, can you sing Kalbach? Sneakunim will come to Reb Nasha Klein. But today, 30, 40 years later, Klal Yisrael has accepted him.
And I will say one thing that Rav Shlomo said at Rabbi Avi Weiss's shul at the Bayit. I remember being there at all the kumzis. Rav Shlomo, you know, one of the things that Rav Shlomo did, and I follow the shita, not in halachically, but in terms of the spirit, he always said that shuls are cold places where people do not feel a connection with their rabbis, with the shul. That all of a sudden is there any reason? Does anyone not understand why when a Jew is disconnected to Yiddishkeit will walk into a church and get a hug and a kiss and a welcome? Is it any wonder why so many, unfortunately, so many Jews have left Yiddishkeit? And so what Shlomo and Avi Weiss at the time, I won't get into that issue anyway, but they would say that we have to do that kind of love. We have to show love to Jews in the shul, let them know how much we care about them. And that's something that I took from Shlomo, even though maybe not the way in which he did it, but the philosophy let every Jew know that they're really important to us, so we love every single one of them.
As I mentioned an hour ago, Yomo gave me a recording, a clear recording, as if Shlomo is sitting in the room and talking directly to you. And he made that point this morning, exactly what I heard. And he attacked the rabbis. I couldn't believe it. He attacked the rebbeim. Wow, he moved himself out of Reb Aaron Cutler's camp and Reb Shlomo Hyman's camp totally and completely. Very powerful. If the religious Zionists ought to get hold of that tape and publicize it. The only thing is, it's in English. And here you don't enter the mainstream unless you're in Hebrew, obviously. But all right, Ot Chazon L'Moed, and what I'm writing now, I'm dealing with that problem, but I'll deal with it a little bit more calmly than Shlomo dealt with, because it's not my goal to push and attack and criticize great Rabbanim, but we can learn how to deal with Torah history and the realities of life. But let me write, let me get there.
A quick proscript to the Torgo story.
Yeah, go ahead.
He was our classmate. He was my classmate at Yeshiva University, and he was elected to the Student Senate, which was quite a prestigious position in those days. And we all understood he was destined for greatness back then. He was a wonderful, charismatic student leader.
So I'll tell you what, I didn't say in class that the one time Rabbi Friedman says to him, "I don't care what you're doing tomorrow, we have to go to see Rav Avram Palm." He says, "But Rabbi, I have appointments. Cancel your appointments." So he cancels. They fly to New York to see Rav Avram Palm. Turns out that there was an item in the Detroit newspapers that they want him to run for senator on the I think it was the Democratic ticket. And Rabbi Friedman got very upset. If he runs for senator, he'll stop being president of the day school. So Rabbi Palm told him, it's a million times more important the day school than to be a United States senator. When they get on the plane going back to Detroit, Rabbi Friedman said, "Let me tell you something else. You wouldn't have won anyway." So it's a beautiful little story.
Well, he was a student senator at Yeshiva University.
All right. Listen, I stand in awe of a person who runs a day school and can raise funds like that. And Detroit today has, again, how long it will last to live in the Detroit area, I guess it's safe in the suburbs, but the city, a Jew walking around, the Sakonet Nefashot, the Arabs are all over the place.
By the way, I don't think Rabbi mentioned, today Gary chairs the Kashrus Commission for the OU.
Oh, I didn't.
He's a lay leader of Rabbi Menachem Gack, Rabbi Ganak's.
Very nice.
Responsibilities. So Gary is the lay leader, which very puts him nice. In the senior leadership of the OU.
Very nice, very nice. Listen, Baruch Hashem, we've created great institutions, but my heart would love to see La Lota Tzavari now. We got to build a country here, and we need more Jews. And the problems here, what this last war brought about, your Arab neighbor is not happy. He wants to kick you out altogether, and we can't escape this reality. Another wonderful Jew just died, a victim of the hotel that was burned. I think he was a guest there. Died yesterday, someone who won Bitachon, Prasim for Bitachon Yisrael. It just breaks the heart where we're at.
Rabbi, what happened? I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. What happened?
Someone died who was injured in the riots. I believe he was in the old part of Akko. He was in a hotel, and he was... You got to read the details.
He was the head of the space agency.
Right. They say he won pras for Bitachon Yisrael, and he lingered for weeks between life and death, and he died yesterday. It's in all the papers today. It's the news, the papers. It's on all the websites. All right. I want to thank you very much for your wonderful participation. Next week will be week with students. Will anyone still be here next week? Okay, Noach, good. Simcha, good.
Yomo, all right. Can we come in? Are we allowed to come in now?
No, wait until the next term. I don't want to start up the... are they allowed to come in? Yoma says they are allowing outsiders into the building.
All our outsiders connected to the Kol.
Outsiders who come to hear Sherman the Kol are allowed in as of Rav Bednash's summer
shir. Yeah, they're already in the basement.
They're already in the basement. So anyone wants, welcome to come next week. Be'ez Ratan Atenli Av Koach until we meet again in health and happiness. Das V'danya.
Rabbi, we were speaking about what they sang at the Deccan. Before I was at least two chuppahs where Rav Shlomo stopped the chasna and the kala, each as they're walking down, and sang to each of them for 20 minutes.
Right.
In one case, we had to explain to the parents that the bedekin doesn't usually last an hour and a half.
Rav Shlomo is Rav Shlomo. Whether that's normative behavior, I'll let you decide. But all right, Bezrat Hashem, we just had a bedekin at the wedding I officiated, and I wasn't even at the bedekin to wish the kala at achatenu hayila alfeder vaba. Her father and father-in-law did it in my stead. But there was a tremendous crowd there, and it was out the big lawn on the kibbutz, so I wanted to get near the chuppah and sit down I was having particular difficulty with my meniscus on that day. Part of it my own making, because I put on a band around the kneecap, and it was stopping the blood from circulating. You can't leave it on too long. And I just totally forgot. I left it on too long, and it was acting up. Later in the car, my daughter was driving us home, and I rolled it down, and it was reborn. So I told the story of the Hasidic Rebbe. Rebbe, my house is so crowded, I have no room. And the Rebbe says, bring in the goats, the cows, the camels. And, Rebbe, it's impossible. Take out the goats, the camels, the cows. Oh, Rebbe, I have so much room. When I lowered it, I was reborn, and I've been good ever since. V'kein hala, I say to the Ribbono Shel Olam, I have so much more to teach. I need so many more years. You have no idea what I have prepared. I'm not talking what I haven't prepared, but I've prepared. But all right, the Eivishter should be kind. And next week is next week, and then we'll worry further. I have to write, and before you know it, we'll start up again. And I hope everyone can be sitting in front of me, L'kavod ul'tiferet, and maybe Mark will come in Aliyah and join us here and have the ability to vote so we can do something to give us democracy and Torah. Torah first, democracy second, the right blend. La Hadil Torah La Hadira. Okay.
I have a Brit Milah and Efrat tomorrow on Zoom.
Who's Brit Milah?
Their name is Hanson. I know the grandparents.
And what's their name?
The family name is Hanson, I think.
And the
the ones I know are her parents from Atlanta.
What's their last name?
Portland.
Enjoy, so Zayn with Mazel. Yomo, you got to kill everything. The Rabbi Bednish has to come in.
I'm not killing anything.
Don't kill, don't kill. Turn off whatever words you want to use. Anyone? This is very interesting. This is, I don't know who put this out, if it's Rabbi Leo's people or the Rebbe's people. It's the visits of Rab Shmuel, of Rab Mordechai Eliyahu with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And it's word by word, their conversation. Very fascinating. If anyone wants the copy, you're welcome. This picture is of the Rav with Rabbi, and it's the best picture I've ever seen of both of them together. If anyone wants a copy, it's yours.